Patricia Baird, and I'm president of the Vancouver Institute for the rest of this calendar year. And I'd like to welcome you here this evening. I'm very glad you came rather than decide to go out trick-or-treating. I want to start off by, as we usually do, reminding you to consider joining the Institute. You'll have seen from our program, because you're here already, so you must have looked at the program, I would think, that we've got a very high caliber of speakers. And it's a great bargain to join. It's only $10 for students and $20 for individuals and $30 for families. So if you could think about that and maybe join on your way out if you're not a member already. I want to mention that this year we have a gift as an inducement to those of you who may think of making a donation to the Institute. If someone donates $75 or more to the Institute, then they receive a free copy of a new book that's about to come out in November, actually. And this is going to be the front cover of it. So we put it up there to entice you even a little bit more. And it's called The Vancouver Institute, An Experiment in Public Education. And it contains the history of the Institute, and also it's over 700 pages because it has the last 3 years' worth of lectures, the text of them. And then, before I introduce tonight's speaker, the last thing I want to mention for those of you who plan ahead is that our speaker next week is Bruno Latour, a sociologist of science who is from France, and so you may wish to plan to come to that. Our speaker this evening is Professor William Chafe. Professor Chafe graduated from Harvard, and he went on to do a master's degree and then a doctoral degree at Columbia University in history. Arising from that work was a book called The American Woman, Her Changing Social, Economic, and Political Roles, which was viewed by many as a path-breaking monograph. Shortly after that, in 1971, he joined the faculty at Duke University, where he has continued serving in various capacities over the years, including as chair of the history department, and more recently, since 1995, as dean of the Faculty of Arts and Science. While at Duke, Professor Chafe also turned his attention toward a second focus, the civil rights movement. And his writings on this topic have been very influential. Over the years, he's managed to be an outstanding teacher, an excellent administrator, and a versatile and prize-winning author. He's been what most people would consider to be a wise and insightful voice in discussions of race and racism and gender discrimination. And the high regard in which he's held is attested to by the many prizes and awards that he's won. I'd like to welcome this evening one of the leading historians in the United States today to speak to us on the topic Feminism and Civil Rights, a Comparative Study of Social Movements, Professor Chafe.
Thank you. This is a wonderful lecture hall and a wonderful audience. I've not been in a lecture hall quite like this since I took NatSci 8 at Harvard in 1959, I think, and it's nice to be back in this kind of a large and imposing room. I really appreciate your coming out tonight, and I want to express my gratitude to the Ida and Cecil B. Green lectureship, because this has been a wonderful week for my wife, Lorna. And myself, we have come to quickly fall in love with Vancouver and to have a great sense of the elan and vitality of this community. It's been just a pure joy for us to be here, and we also appreciate the fact that you've shown us a full diversity of your weather patterns, including a beautiful day of sunshine, which we love because we are, above all, seaside people. Our spiritual home is in the state of Maine, and your beautiful coastline gives us a real sense of being back where we actually most love to be. When I was asked to do this lecture, I was told a little bit about the Vancouver Institute and the degree to which this is a very active and engaged audience, which likes to talk about issues of significance and controversy and currency in the contemporary world. And so I decided that of all the issues that I really wanted to bring to you, the one that would be perhaps most generative of good discussion and conversation tonight is really also one of the most important questions facing American society in the United States. And I sometimes use the word American when I'm referring to the United States, and I apologize to you. I don't mean to be in any way more imperialistic than my country already is. Nevertheless, it is something which may come out as a matter of habit, so I ask your apologies in advance. The issue which is really at the bottom of my presentation tonight is the question of the relationship between group identity in United States society and individual identity. This is a very burning question. If you look at our columnists and our newspapers, you will see people becoming quite livid at the notion of people wanting to be treated as members of groups. And insisting that, in fact, ours is not a society where group or collective identity is important. Ours is really a society totally based upon individualism, where every person needs to be looked at, treated, assessed in terms of their own quite peculiar characteristics. And that talking about groupness is some kind of political correctness, some kind of insidious subversion of what the American way of life is all about. I'm going to argue against that tonight, but I think certainly that the nature of this controversy and debate is one that goes really to the heart of what we are about in the United States and how we deal with the process and question of social change. Clearly, the United States, historically at least, is based upon the idea of equal opportunity for all, with the notion that individuals would be able to achieve whatever they might be able to achieve according to their talents. This is the natural aristocracy of Thomas Jefferson, embedded in the Declaration of Independence and its famous credos of all men are created equal with certain inalienable rights. It is also the premise of what the famous historian Richard Hofstadter once wrote in his book, The American Political Tradition, in which he said that the United States was the only nation in history conceived in perfection and dedicated to progress. I think it's a telling comment that through most of our history, we have wanted desperately to believe that Jefferson's description of ourselves as a society of equal opportunity with a natural aristocracy in which individuals could achieve whatever their talents led them to achieve was true. We've desperately wanted to believe in that myth. In fact, it has been a creed which has carried down and also been an inspiration to millions of people who have tried to bring about improvement and reform in American society. But as anyone who has looked at the history of the United States will readily attest, and probably the history of any society, ours is clearly not a history based upon equal opportunity or individualism, but rather one in which our experience as individuals has been directly shaped by our participation in various group identities. Certainly, the sex into which we are born has been critical through almost all of our history in determining the power we have, the rights we can exercise, the careers we can aspire to, the clothes we wear, the emotions we're taught to cultivate, the way in which we interact with each other, and the way in which we think of ourselves. Even more so is that the case depending on whether one is white or black. Whether one is Latino or Anglo, whether one is Asian or Caucasian. And it is very clear that because of those characteristics, and adding to them the characteristic of poverty, that group identity, in fact, has been the driving force that has determined the fate of virtually all American citizens throughout our history. In fact, you could argue, I think effectively, that the only people who have enjoyed any kind of historic equal opportunity are people like myself, people who happen to be white, who happen to be middle class, who happen to be male. People, therefore, have had at least some opportunity to be able to achieve something based upon their own individual talent. I like to tell the story. I'm in sort of my own example of upward mobility within that paradigm. I'd like to talk about the fact that I'm a third-generation Harvard person. My grandfather and grandmother came here from Yorkshire in England in 1903, and my grandfather was a night watchman at Harvard. And my grandmother was a cafeteria worker at Harvard. My uncle was a policeman at Harvard. My mother was a secretary at Harvard, and I became a student at Harvard. So, to some extent, there is upward mobility in American society. And yet, very little of that would in all likelihood have happened were it not for the fact that I am also white and male. And by the time my generation came along, was able to be also part of a family where economic security was present and it was possible for me to have those opportunities. In fact, I think what we've been dealing with throughout American history is the degree to which the tension between group identity and individual identity is an intrinsic part of our entire social process. And the point I really want to zero in on tonight is not the degree to which those are in fact oppositional categories, but rather the degree to which there is a dialectic that exists between them. That in effect it is only possible to begin to achieve the possibility of individual rights if one departs from and operates on the basis of a strong sense of collective group identity. That in fact, group identity is the sacred home base from which one leaves as a source of strength and a return in order to interact with and hopefully enter into a more egalitarian relationship with the dominant society. So far from being at opposite ends of each other, there is, in fact, I think, an intrinsic relationship between these two identities, individual and group, which we must understand and which we must affirm both equally if we are to be able to achieve the kind of pluralistic and democratic society that we really want to achieve. So the point I want to make tonight is that the progress that those groups have made, or those individuals have made, who are parts of groups who have been oppressed in the United States over time, is a progress that could not have happened without it starting from a strong, cohesive, affirmative, clearly articulated sense of group identity. And that with that as a foundation stone, it has been possible to move forward into the kind of interaction with a larger society, which at some point makes it possible to maybe make progress and achieve the possibility of greater individual freedom. Tonight I want to talk about both the history of the women's movement and the history of the black freedom struggle as examples of this intersection between group identity and individual identity, and the ways in which we need to see these in creative tension with each other. There will be time as we go on to emphasize the importance of having a positive sense of group identity as opposed to a negative sense, and also at the end of this discussion to talk about one of the least talked about aspects of group identity in America, indeed one which I will come to as a critical decisive intervening point at the end, which is the variable and the group identity of class. So let's begin by talking about the early women's movement in the 19th century. The women's movement really begins in the 19th century as part of the abolitionist freedom struggle to end slavery in the United States. Women become involved in that movement, not really because they are individuals, because in fact women did not exist in the public realm as individuals at that point. They could not vote. They could not have a higher education. They could not pursue careers. They were not allowed to, in fact, be active individual citizens in the society, not recognized either in the Constitution or in the Declaration of Independence. But they did become involved in the struggle to free blacks from slavery. And they became involved in that struggle on the basis of their group identity, on the degree to which they were acting as women coming out of a strong sense of women-centered institutions, fulfilling what they saw to be a part of their collective identity. Here, we are talking about the degree to which women joined the abolitionist struggle as members of women's missionary societies, members of voluntary associations that were specifically concerned with acting to make the United States a more moral place, to be able to uphold and enhance the spiritual well-being of the society, and to move toward fulfilling their commitment to moral nurturance and spiritual uplift. In other words, they were acting out of a sense of being a collective different from others in the society. And under that guise, and within that sense of overall responsibility to improve morality and spirituality in the society, women were able to take part in the abolitionist struggle, to join with the men in that movement to try to abolish slavery in the United States. Of course, it quickly became clear they couldn't do that, at least not in the same way that men could do it, because they were not allowed to speak in public, they were not allowed to carry petitions, they were not allowed to express themselves in the full manner in which they chose to express themselves or would like to have expressed themselves. And it became clear, in the words of Angelina Grimke, one of the early women abolitionists, that until we remove the foot of oppression from our own necks, we cannot work to achieve liberation for those whom we seek to free. That, in turn, becomes the basis for the kind of dialogue between women which creates the effort by women as a collective group to call attention to their own plight within the society. It leads directly to the convening of the Seneca Falls Conference of 1848 and the Declaration of Rights and Grievances, modeled directly after the Declaration of Independence that comes out of the Seneca Falls Conference in 1848. Now, what's interesting is this particular document represents in many ways precisely the dialectic I'm talking about, because it grows out of women coming together, acting on behalf of their own sense of group identity and affirmation of that, and ends up with a document which is profoundly radical in its call for total individualism and the abolition of the idea of sexual spheres. Because what the Seneca Falls Declaration does is to ask for an end to the double standard of morality. It asks for the ability of women to make contracts, to pursue careers, to be able to get a higher education, and above all, to be able to get the right to vote. These are individual rights, and yet they are asked for on the basis of a sense of collective protest, and they end up with the demand for the kind of equal protection under the laws and equal citizenship that supposedly is promised in the Declaration of Independence. Indeed, this kind of model is the quintessence of the dialectic that I'm talking about this evening between the sense of having a strong affirmative sense of collective self and the desire to seek a way of being accepted within the larger society. Most of the women who are involved in the women's movements of the 19th century reflect the same sense of the dialectic. Most of the leaders of the movement in the late 19th century, for example, come out of the women's colleges. They don't come out of men's colleges. They don't come out of co-ed institutions. They come out of institutions that are women-centered and women-defined. Many of these women have had an interesting experience. They've had the experience in college of being told that they should free their minds, pursue whatever their intellects lead them to, and practice in the world, at least of the college, the same kind of intellectual independence as male students do. And then there occurs graduation, and what Jane Addams says is the sudden reimposition of the family claim upon the women whose minds have been freed. The genie is out of the bottle, and suddenly they are told the genie must go back inside the bottle, and the minds that have been freed to be engaged in their own pursuits of knowledge must now go back to joining clubs and playing whist and becoming, in effect, people who are not involved in the outside world. Well, this generation, a whole generation indeed, of women's college graduates, decide they are not satisfied with that, and they are going to become involved in creating their own niche in society, which becomes known as the Settlement House Movement. The Settlement House Movement is a wonderful example of the way in which women, acting as women, make a huge contribution to the society at large and eventually provide a means by which women themselves can become significant players within that world. The Settlement House Movement is almost too perfect in terms of the way in which it provides a vehicle in which, in a very not intentionally insidious or subversive way, but ultimately very productive way, women become major political actors in the early 20th century of America. Because the Settlement House, of course, is, first of all, a house. in which women live together, occasionally with some men, planted within large urban communities, primarily inner-city ghettos, in which the women who are there, living there, are doing, quote-unquote, domestic things. In other words, they are doing things which are consistent with what society defines as women's separate sphere. On the other hand, they are also carrying out the kinds of desire to be engaged and have an impact on the society around them that they have learned through their experiences in college. And as they go out and try to work with immigrant families on issues of factory health safety, on issues of cesspools in the sewers outside the houses, on the issues of sweatshop labor and the diseases that come from sweatshop labor, they are not only acting out what is seen to be a role consistent with women's definition as a separate group, but they are also inevitably becoming involved in the process of transforming and changing the society. Because as they get involved, looking at factories where children are working, looking at factories where machines are cutting off the hands of workers, looking at the kinds of lack of public safety regulations dealing with transportation and other areas, they inevitably become involved in devising solutions to those problems. And as they devise solutions to those problems, they become involved in politics. And as they become involved in politics, they become active in their own behalf. And they become the ones who are responsible for creating the minimum wage laws, the factory safety laws, the child labor laws, all of those things that, in fact, we tend to boast about as being the pride and joy of the progressive movement. Now, I would argue that, from a United States historian's point of view, the progressive movement is not a very progressive period. It's very difficult to give that label overall to what we call the progressive movement. But I would also argue that most of what is truly progressive about the progressive period, namely those child safety laws, the factory safety laws, the minimum wage laws, all come out of the settlement house movement and come out of woman-defined and woman-centered institutions. It is also via those institutions that women make their final assault on the bastion of the male-only franchise. And this also goes back to the sense of, again, a separate sense of collective identity. Jane Addams, one of the founders of the Settlement House movement, the one who is responsible for Hull House and for so much else that goes on within the Settlement House movement, writes an article in the Ladies' Home Journal in 1910. It's a very, very important article, in which she makes the very strong and compelling argument that women deserve the right to vote and must have the right to vote because they are the housekeepers of the country. And because they are the housekeepers of the country, only if they have the right to vote can they sweep clean the national house, get rid of the immorality and disease which is infecting the house, and make it possible for that house to become fully democratic and successful in its ability to address the needs of all its citizens. Only then, after they clean out the dirt from the house, eliminate the corruption of the politics of Wall Street and Washington, only then can the democracy of the United States achieve its true destiny. And so we have, as this whole campaign evolves, this wonderful example of both the Seneca Falls group of women in the first place and the leaders of the women's rights movement in the late 19th century, early 20th century in the other, using their experience as part of a clearly defined, separate group of people with a strong, positive sense of what women have to offer as the basis for demanding inclusion within a larger society and the opportunity to become part of that society. This combination, this desire to combine a demand for individual rights with the assertion that women have a specific and particular role to contribute, is one that really in many ways reflects clearly the profound positive tension that I'm trying to talk about tonight. That's a tension that really goes on in the aftermath of this movement as well in the 1920s. Once the 19th Amendment has been ratified and women have the right to vote, it continues all the way through the 20s, 30s, and 40s. We have the example of the National Women's Party. Again, a separate women's party. There are no men allowed anywhere near the National Women's Party. The National Women's Party in 1923 is the group that first introduces the Equal Rights Amendment, which is not passed by Congress until 1972, literally 49 years later. And yet, the Equal Rights Amendment, in fact, is a plea to
completely abolish all barriers of discrimination against women. At the same time, other women's groups like the League of Women Voters, the Women's Trade Union League, the National Consumers League, are themselves acting within a political framework in order to try to get social welfare legislation, once again, on the premise of the degree to which women have a particular responsibility to pursue this kind of activity. Well, I think that this kind of dialectic is one that we will come back to when we talk about the women's movement of the 1960s, but it is an important one to use as a model for the ways in which people are activated to work on their own behalf in order to seek significant change and improvement within their society. I believe the same kind of tension and dialectic can be seen within the black struggle for freedom. We have a tendency, of course, to think about the period of slavery in America as one in which there was absolutely no sense of self among the African-American slave community, a total control by the white master class, a lack of any kind of intrinsic identity within the African-American slave community, which I think we now understand to be totally wrong, because notwithstanding the oppression that existed within that slave community, we also have got a new appreciation for the degree to which the slave community itself had a tremendous sense of integrity. It developed its own religious, spiritual, musical, artistic traditions, as well as a clear sense of community identity and solidarity. That becomes, in turn, the basis for the community that exists in the aftermath of the Civil War. And although Reconstruction itself, at the end of the Civil War, seems to articulate primarily a demand for individual rights, reflected in the 14th Amendment, which provides equal protection under the laws, but does not apply to women, and talks about the franchise for males, all of which are individual rights, there is also an equal amount of attention that's devoted within the African-American community toward the nurturing and development of a separate institutional life, the degree to which the black church becomes a pivotal part of the community, the emphasis upon creating black schools for children to get educated, to have the opportunity to improve themselves and make it within the society, the emphasis on the development of black colleges, whether it be Morehouse, Hampton, Tuskegee, all those schools that today still remain as primary examples and instruments of black self-assertion and rallying points for black political advocacy. All of these became critically important parts of what goes on within black America, not seeking to dissolve into the community, rather seeking to come together and find strength within solidarity. This dual approach of both things being present at the same time goes on really throughout the rest of the 19th century and into the 20th century. For every Frederick Douglass who is advocating the kind of equal political rights and integration of blacks into the political mainstream, there is also a Martin Delaney advocating black nationalism. The most famous example of this dualism is generally portrayed as the relationship between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois. Washington, someone who advocates blacks coming together and in effect helping themselves through collective efforts at self-improvement with agricultural training and things like this, industrial training, and advocating really a kind of separateness from the larger society. With Du Bois, on the other hand, being seen as the champion of individual rights based at least in part on his own experience, an experience which starts with his being a young teenager in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. He becomes the first black person to get a PhD from Harvard University. He has all of the experience of walking as an individual philosophy student on the paths of the University of Heidelberg and thinks very much about the ideas of being treated as an individual without regard to race. And yet Du Bois also understands the importance of cooperation and of emphasizing black solidarity and identity, and especially in terms of economic self-help. And the contrast between Du Bois and Washington is often far too boldly stated, even though Washington took a public stance of not trying to urge blacks to operate together politically. Privately, he was engaging in correspondence that in fact urged black self-assertion politically. And even though Du Bois publicly took a stance of being solely for integration and individual rights, he is in fact acting strongly to advocate cooperatives among black citizens, and in the aftermath of World War I, himself becomes the founder of the Pan-Africanist movement and celebrates the notion of black identity across national boundaries of race and color. I'm going to need a glass of water, and is there a... Thank you. I think if we look at the civil rights struggle itself, we have an even better example of this particular tension in a positive sense. As many of you know, I've written a book about the civil rights movement, focusing on the sit-in movement in North Carolina. And that's in many ways the classic example of a movement which appears to be strictly on behalf of integration and individual rights and equal opportunity and equal protection under the laws. The story is really very simple. It involves a group of four first-year students at a black college in Greensboro, North Carolina. These are students who have been about 13 or 14 years old when the Brown decision was passed down by the Supreme Court in 1954. The Brown decision, of course, mandated that segregation was no longer constitutional and desegregation must take place. These students were politically of age when they heard that decision. They understood what it meant. They expected rapid change, as did many people in the African-American community at that point in time. What they found instead, that there was very little change took place, even in Greensboro, which was supposedly a more quote-unquote progressive southern community, and which in fact had said it would comply with the Brown decision, but really never did so. And as they grew up and became adolescents and moved forward into their late teens, they reached a point where they were frustrated by the absence of any kind of significant progress taking place. And they understood when they started college that they were at a critical point in time. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Because if they were to simply go along with the way things were, if they were not to do something to protest this, then even as the younger generation, they would become accomplices in their own oppression. And this was something that they felt they could not allow themselves to do. And so they talked among themselves, they talked about what they could do to challenge the status quo, and they struck upon, in their late-night conversations, a very dramatic but powerful message. They would highlight the moral absurdity and the economic inanity of segregation by going and demonstrating how stupid it was. They would go down to the Five and Dime store, the Woolworths in Greensboro, where blacks shopped just as whites shopped, and they would buy the things they could buy at the counters where they were allowed to shop with whites, their toothpaste, their pencils, their notebooks. They would keep their receipts from there, and then they would go and ask to be served at the lunch counter where, in fact, blacks were not allowed to sit. And they said, now, if we do this, we will basically be pointing out in a very powerful, dramatic fashion how absurd it is that we should be served just like every other person, white person, at the rest of these counters and not allowed to be served at this final counter where you would have the opportunity to drink a cup of coffee. And so they went to the lunch counter with their receipts in hand, asked for a cup of coffee, and they were told, we do not serve Negroes here. Now, they were scared to death because they did not know what was going to happen. They were totally terrified that their parents were going to be fired. They were terrified that they were going to be arrested. They might be beaten. They were afraid for their lives. And yet they felt they had to do something. Now, they sat down there, they opened their books, and they studied for the rest of the afternoon, and the store finally closed. They went back to the campus, and the word spread of what they'd done. The next day, the four became 23. The day after that, the 23 became 66. The day after that, the 66 became 100. And on the fifth day, there were 1,000 students in downtown Greensboro demanding to be served at the local Five and Dime stores. Within 30 days, sit-in demonstrations had broken out in 54 different cities in 9 different states. Within 60 days, a student nonviolent coordinating committee had been created in Raleigh, North Carolina, at Shaw University. And within the year, the New York Times had started to have a 3 or 4 page section, each paper, describing what was going on in civil rights demonstrations across the country. Now, these were demonstrations which clearly represented a demand for equal opportunity and being treated as individuals, not with no regard whatsoever for racial background or racial anything having to do with what the color of the skin was. But where did they get the strength from? Why did they do this? Where did this come from? Well, that's a more complicated story. In many ways, that strength came precisely out of those black institutions of self-affirming people coming together and joining together that made it possible for them to take that step. They could never have done it as individuals without that kind of background, without that kind of home base, without that kind of departure point. What were those institutions? Well, it was Dudley High School, the all-black high school in Greensboro, North Carolina, a place with tremendous sense of elan, with faculty and students who really felt a great sense of community identity with that school. They had teachers who gave them messages which they learned well. There was a chemistry teacher named Vance Chavis who used to have in homeroom before the students went off to their classes during the day, used to have his students sit there and address envelopes, voter registration envelopes, asking members of the black community to make sure they went out and registered to vote. This is in the high school before classes started in Dudley High School. They had a teacher named Nell Coley who would teach them all the literature, Thomas Hardy and William Shakespeare, but also make sure they understood that this literature was for them. They could also write this literature. They could also aspire to be these kinds of people. They should never accept second-class treatment. They went to a church, the Shiloh Baptist Church, pastored by the largest Baptist church in Greensboro, Black Baptist Church, pastored by a minister named Otis Harrison, who had himself been an activist in promoting civil rights causes at the all-black Shaw University in Raleigh, North Carolina, the all-black university that became the birthplace of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in April of 1960. And they had gone to an NAACP youth group where they had met every week during the 1950s to talk about what was going on throughout the country in response to the Brown decision. An NAACP youth group which had been founded by a woman named Ella Baker, who was in many ways the mother of the civil rights movement, who herself had grown up in Warren County, North Carolina, had gone to Shaw University, and had become a field worker for the NAACP, and had started this youth group in 1943. In other words, where they came from was from a set of powerful African-American institutions which made it possible for them and created the framework within which they could then go out and demand these individual rights, rights that they would not have been able to demand, I believe, had they not come out of that strength of community and sense of positive group identity. So the movement could not have happened without the base from which it came. And the base was essentially grounded in the sense of positive group identity and an affirmation of the importance of the African-American history and culture. That really continues all the way through the civil rights movement of the 1960s. We have this image, particularly through the mass media, of the civil rights movement as only emphasizing individual rights. We think about the March on Washington in 1963, a march in which there were hundreds of thousands of blacks and whites marching together. And we think about the famous speech by Martin Luther King Jr., one of the most dramatic lines of which that he yearns for the day when his daughter will be judged by the content of her character rather than by the color of her skin, a clear plea for individual treatment without regard to race. What we don't necessarily remember is that the March on Washington was a march for jobs and freedom. Jobs and freedom. That it was put together by a man named A. Philip Randolph, A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin, both of whom were veterans and founders of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union, an all-black union, who came together and made one of the premises of the March on Washington, a demand for a Marshall Plan that would deal with African Americans on a collective basis, not just for individual rights. And all the way through, I think, the Civil Rights Movement, we have this continuing strengthening of this dialectic in which the sense of group identity is what makes possible the demand for individual rights. And although subsequently people tended to see the emergence of black power as a contradiction to and a rebuttal of the integrationist phase of the Civil Rights Movement, in fact, I believe the black power movement was simply an expression in a different way of many of the same values and ideals that had been there all along. Let's go back finally to the women's movement of the 1960s for another look. Really, this is what is frequently called the second stage of feminism, but in fact is probably the 10th stage of feminism and multiple feminisms in the 1960s. But here, too, we have a situation in which there is a juncture between the issues of sex and race, in which the attention to the need to do something about the ways in which women are discriminated against is crystallized and heightened by the experience of working toward the end of racial discrimination, and in which there was a clear connection between attacking the use of race, a physical characteristic, as a basis for discrimination under the law, and the use of sex, another physical characteristic, as the basis for discrimination under the law. And so when the civil rights legislation of the 1960s comes in 1964, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the most important piece of legislation passed during this period, that legislation not only outlaws discrimination in employment and hiring and promotion on the basis of race, but also outlaws discrimination in employment and hiring on the basis of sex. And that, in turn, leads to a new focus on the degree to which sex is insidious and powerful, a source of discrimination and powerlessness in the United States as race is. Now, there had been, throughout the early 1960s, a number of people who had been organizing around issues of gender discrimination. One of these was the President's Commission, set up by John F. Kennedy, on the status of women. That, in turn, was accompanied by a whole series of state commissions on the status of women throughout the country, which resulted in a 1963 report to the President and ultimately ended in the passage of the Equal Pay Act of 1963. And helped to provide the framework within which the 1964 Civil Rights Act could incorporate sex as one of the issues that was acted upon. Well, in the aftermath of the 64 Civil Rights Act, what became clear was that the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, which was set up to enforce the Civil Rights Act, was not paying any attention to discrimination complaints on the basis of sex. They were following through on complaints about race. They were doing nothing about complaints on the basis of sex, even though there were more of those than there were on the basis of race. Now, what happens there is that all the members of these commissions on the status of women come together at an annual meeting to, in effect, reestablish their contacts over the years, and they look at what's being done, and they realize that nothing is being enforced. And it is exactly out of that background that Betty Friedan and a whole series of other people who are veterans of those state commissions create the National Organization for Women in 1966. Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, had been published in 1963. That organization becomes, in a sense, another example of a women's organization which draws upon the strength of a set of network affiliations that go back through these commissions of the status of women, and now becomes involved as a collective departure point for legislating or seeking legislation and litigating around the issues of the denial of rights to women. Now, the denial of rights to women leads them to ask for integration of women into the economic mainstream, for women to be treated as individuals like all other individuals in terms of economic opportunity. And so they successfully demand the elimination of male-only and female-only classified columns in the employment classifieds, the newspapers. They successfully attack the exclusion of women from private clubs and from bars on the same grounds that African Americans had attacked the exclusion of blacks from such places on the basis of race. They have one wonderful campaign in which they mount a vigorous and highly successful campaign against United Airlines, which was advertising in the newspapers an executive-only, male-only flight every day from Chicago to New York at 5 o'clock, in which men only would be admitted to the plane, and they would be served in turn by attractive female flight attendants. They succeeded in getting that eliminated. Now, what they're clearly seeking here is a series of advances so that women, as individuals, can be accepted into the larger economic and social framework. They can have the same opportunities for career success. They can be admitted into graduate schools they hadn't been admitted into before. They can have the access to jobs that had not been available for them before. But again, it is the relationship between the two things that is absolutely important to emphasize. Now, there are another group of women as well who become involved and activated in the civil rights, in the women's movement because of the civil rights struggle. And those are the young women who have been serving on the front lines of the Southern student movement, risking their lives, being involved in the most dangerous kinds of circumstances, demanding voter registration and opening up of public facilities for blacks in the South. And also discovering, as had their foremothers 130 years earlier, that even though they were risking their lives, they were not given the same rights. They were not allowed to take part in the decision-making process. They were expected to do all the domestic chores. And they, too, decided that they needed to stand up in the same way the women at Seneca Falls had done. And they published a memorandum called Sex and Caste, a Kind of Oppression, in which they draw a parallel between the relationship between racial and sexual discrimination, and demand that women should be treated in a very different way, and in fact that the entire structure of values in the society should be reconsidered from the perspective of women. Now, eventually, this leads to the development of a whole series of different kinds of feminism in the late 1960s, which have many different names. There is certainly this cultural feminism, this radical feminism, the socialist feminism, a whole group of these. But all of them are premised upon the idea that women need to act in a separate way in order to change the society, in order to challenge its values, in order to challenge the hierarchies that exist, in order to talk about there being a different kind of life based upon the fact that women have a different perspective. And that perspective has to be recognized and understood. Well, as a consequence of all of these things, there are certainly significant changes that take place. Many changes need of a very positive nature. Because of the Civil Rights Act, because of the women's movement, certainly there are changes in people's heads. In 1962, two-thirds of all women questioned in a Gallup poll said they did not believe there was discrimination against women. 8 years later, that was 50%. In 1974, it was two-thirds saying, yes, there was discrimination, and yes, it had to be ended. In 1965, 63% of women questioned said that the most important source of fulfillment for women was being wives and mothers. 20 years later, that figure was down to 8%. There was a change of dramatic proportions in the ways in which women thought about themselves, certainly, especially women who had the opportunity to go to college. You have the experience of dramatic. It was never more than 5%. Never more than 5%. Internships were not made available to more than 5% of that was one of the criteria. You could not have women hired as interns. The same thing clearly was true of law firms and of business executive business companies. That's in 1970. By the late 1980s, we're talking about 40 to 50% enrollments in all these schools of women. A dramatic shift has taken place. Opportunities have opened up that were not there before. There was still a glass ceiling, but there was significant change. Many of the same things happened with African Americans. We have a 500% increase in the number of black college students between 1962 and 1976, largely because of the kinds of shifts that are taking place. You have a tremendous change as a result of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, in which you have large numbers of African Americans being elected to public office. You have a growth in the number of black sheriffs, black judges, black congressmen, black senators, etc. And in all this is also significant economic change. There is desegregation of housing. There is a movement of many blacks from the inner city to the suburbs. There is the growth of a black middle class, to the point where some people even claim there's no longer a problem. Of course, the degree to which those things happen has its own interesting dynamic and story. Those people who are successful, whether they be women or African Americans or both, those people who are successful are largely people who are in a position to take advantage of the rights that have been won through this entire history of struggle. People who have an economic foundation which gives them the wherewithal to be able to get a decent education and to be able to have security and comfort. People who have the college degree that will allow them to take advantages of the new employment opportunities or career opportunities that develop. Unfortunately, very little of this passes down to those who do not have those economic and educational foundations to start with. Because the other side of the picture is the continued immiseration of large numbers of women and African Americans. A poverty rate among black families that continues to be 30 to 35%. The fact that poverty in the United States becomes increasingly associated with female-headed families, in which it was expected that by the year 2000, the vast majority of poor people in the United States would be women and children. A situation in which, even though large numbers of women continue to join the labor force, in fact, you now have as many women working as you have men working in most cases, 80% of the women who are working are in 5% of all jobs. 80% are in 5% of all jobs. And that 5% of all jobs are those jobs that have the least opportunity for upward mobility, for decent benefits, and for improvement in wages. So what we have, in effect, is a situation in which there is a bifurcation. You also have a situation in which there is growing negative attention toward the idea of group identity, in which, for example, there is a public reaction against the idea of affirmative action, against the idea of blacks wanting to be treated as differently because they're blacks, or of Asians or Latinos wanting to be treated differently because of their background. There is a reaction against some of the radical feminist groups because they are seen to be separatist and man-hating. And there is a degree to which, in effect, there is a new cultural denunciation of the idea of any kind of affirmation of group identity, which in some ways brings us to the final notion of group characteristic that we have yet to deal with in American society, and it speaks directly to the bifurcation I've described in terms of the experience of African Americans and women in the aftermath of the gains made during the civil rights and feminist revolutions of the 1960s. And that's the problem of class. Class clearly is something which affects all those people who were not able to take advantage of the new rights that existed, who did not have the opportunity to move into the mainstream of the society to get the better jobs, to get the better education, to get the kinds of prosperity which existed. Class is something which, as most of you know very well, is something which we don't believe exists in the United States, in which we are taught we should not even think about, let alone talk about. And hence we have the example of the huge percentage of American people who describe themselves as middle class. A middle class person is someone who makes $30,000 a year and is very contented with that. A middle class person is someone who makes $800,000 a year and is also very contented with that. And it involves all those in between. They all think of themselves and talk about themselves as middle class. And there is very little sense, certainly no very little positive sense, of what it means to talk about being working class. Working class is something which you want to abjure rather than embrace, and the notion of having a collective sense of being victims of an economically inequitable society is one which is highly discouraged. But where does that leave us all at the end of a century? It leaves us in some ways, from my point of view, in a situation where I think we need to rethink the way in which we use and talk about ideas of group identity versus individual identity, not allow ourselves to get caught up in the kind of political denunciation of group identity which has now become sort of de rigueur within our society, recognize the importance of the degree to which a positive sense of group identity is something which has been inextricably connected to all the progress that has taken place within our society in the past 50 years. Recognizing also that diversity is something which is part of all of us in the society, not just those who we define as the other. And so I think we need to address the degree to which collective disabilities remain pivotal to our inability to achieve the goals that Jefferson first talked about in the Declaration of Independence, and particularly the degree to which issues of gender,
race, and class, continue to become intertwined to make a mockery out of the idea that individualism and equal opportunity exist. Rather, we need to address in a forceful, intentional, and collective fashion the degree to which there remain these fundamental problems in our society, which can only be addressed not by paying attention to individuals, but by recognizing the degree to which group characteristics continue to make it impossible for individuals to have the kind of freedom we talk about. Only if we do this will it be possible to even think about reaching the point that Richard Hofstadter talked about 50 years ago, a society conceived in perfection yet dedicated to progress. Thank you.
Professor Chafe is going to take some questions, and I hope you will repeat the question when you get it first.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask you, do you feel in the United States,
yes, the question is, do I believe, on the basis of my experience in the United States, that there are still major political differences in the perspectives or outlooks of men versus women, and if so, what are the origins of those differences? The answer to the first question is yes, there are significant differences. We actually see developing over the last 20 years a growing gender gap in the perspective of women and men toward both primarily political issues, with an interesting focus on the part of women, I think, again, not all women. It's very important not to essentialize women, but there is a distinction clearly between the perspective of women on both candidates, parties, and issues. On issues, there seems to be a great willingness to commit to questions of, for example, programs for child care, programs for social welfare, programs that will improve the well-being of the health and well-being of average citizens. Women more likely to be supportive of those kinds of measures. I believe women are more likely to be supportive of almost virtually everything that has a kind of social welfare or collectivist kind of program. You know, there's not been a male Democratic candidate for the presidency who has won a majority of white male votes since 1964. We are now talking about, 34 years now of white male Democrats not getting white male voters in support. That means, in effect, that the Democratic base has growingly been made up of ethnic minorities and of women. That becomes more clear, it seems, as time goes by, and the gender gap remains what seems to be a very pivotal issue in the coming election next Tuesday, where notwithstanding the aberrant behavior of our president, women are, for the most part, committed to forgiving him and supporting him in much larger numbers than men are. So the answer, I think, is that there seems to be evidence that there is a distinctive perspective and a distinctive response on the part of women, although it would be egregious to talk about it as being anything like overwhelming, but certainly a majority, and a significant majority. Yes, sir. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, let me try to repeat the question. I'll try to do it simply. Both Kennedy and King recognized the degree to which class and poverty was a huge problem, without regard, I mean, that it was not just racial. And the questioner posits that the degree to which various groups in the United States have practiced a politics of identity, that is, say, focusing on their own ethnic or other group characteristic as the foremost consideration, that has prohibited the development of a broader-based, citizen-based coalition. I think that's a... is that a fair statement? Okay. I don't see the two as exclusive. I think that, you know, we have many examples, not many, we have some examples of efforts to develop the kind of coalition you're talking about around economic interests. The two most notable examples of that are in the populist movement of the 1890s, in which there was at least some effort to unite the Colored Farmers Alliance with the Southern White Farmers Alliance around issues of economic common need as sharecroppers and tenant farmers and small yeoman farmers. And that eventually was destroyed on the basis of, in effect, the upper class playing the race card and, in effect, demanding the disenfranchisement of blacks and using white solidarity as the basis for putting down that economic coalition. A second example of it probably would characterize the late 1930s and early 1940s with the Congress of Industrial Organizations and its effort to successfully try to bring industrial workers together, regardless of their ethnic origins and across racial lines. And that, too, was successful up to a point where, at the end of World War II, you have, in effect, the destruction of the most progressive unions that practiced those policies, largely in response to the fear that they were going to become communist-oriented and therefore they had to be purged from the union scene. I would argue that that what we need at this moment is not to dissolve or deflect attention from the degree to which people are members of different groups, the politics of identity, but rather to try to use those groups as a basis for building bridges and developing coalitions. That it is far easier to develop mutually respectful combinations of resources and support for each other if one is willing to recognize the degree to which intrinsic to those groups' existence is that sense of being part of a common experience. I think that there's no reason why that cannot or should not happen. What's missing here is the willingness to affirm on a positive level the degree to which there is a shared economic interest. That becomes really the problem of the American labor movement in being able to generate, or the United States labor movement, being able to generate a clearer and more positive sense of sharing a common goal that indeed needs to recognize differences based upon ethnicity or other kinds of group identification, but can be overcome by a sense of what is shared in common as part of a collective struggle. Now, I think that there has in some ways been a psychological shift within the labor movement toward that direction. It is not a shift that is decisive at this point, but there is, I think, more of a sense of being willing to be aggressive and affirmative now than there has been in the last 10 years, and not being quite so defeatist pessimistic as had been the case. But only when that really becomes something that people can rally around is it likely we'll be able to move beyond where we are at the present time. In the back? Okay. No, I think actually they were for both.
Yeah, they were both. The main to emphasize the struggle for individual.
Yeah.
Now you're saying the focus should shift, but
What I probably didn't state clearly enough was that all the way through, as I tried to state with the March on Washington, for example, that was not just a fight for individual rights. That was a fight for collective black rights. If we look at the issue of the suffrage movement, that was not just a fight for women to have the right to vote. It was a fight for women as a group to advance collectively to make differences in policy which would benefit women. So I think that both things were going on. I don't see them as being necessarily contradictory or opposed to each other. I do think, nevertheless, that what we have not recognized is the degree to which the struggle for individual rights could not exist without the strong group base. But I think that you do point out an issue which I wasn't as clear on as I should have been. In the back.
You foresee in the not too distant future the election of a humanist, feminist, perhaps even large number of women to political positions.
Well, I think if Liddy Dole is nominated in 2000, you may see someone real fast. I actually think that you are far more likely to see a woman president and larger numbers of women in office than you're likely to see a black president, although Colin Powell certainly is someone who would still be a viable candidate were he to be nominated. But I do think that you have a number of women who are playing very critical roles right now and may well have a chance that most men are not taking to try to redirect the nature of the debate and discourse that's taking place within our society. It's interesting to me that if you look at what's going on right now, the focal point of attention this weekend within the Democratic Party is someone named Hillary Clinton. She's the one who's out there doing all the campaigning, or doing a lot of it and getting a whole lot of attention, and in some ways making more sense than some of the other people. Yes, sir. I didn't understand the biological. Will you repeat the biological part of that? The first part. Yes. The question is, given the degree to which women biologically are more involved in the care of children, is it not intelligent or wise that daycare centers should be relocated toward places of work rather than away from places of work? I think we are going through an interesting period of time, at least I would say some of the society is going through an interesting process of change in which the premise of your question may not necessarily correspond with at least the reality of some families, in which, in fact, there's a great deal more involvement of men and fathers in child care, certainly not to the same degree as there is women and mothers, but nevertheless some significant change. I think that there has been an effort to think through where to locate child care centers, and there's been some effort on the part of some corporations to in fact have child care centers at the place of business. There are also some problems with that, and they have to do with the surrounding areas, the proximity of recreational facilities, and health issues. In terms of the numbers of, daycare centers are frequently places where there's some degree of illness. I might ask my wife if she has a comment on that, because she's a daycare person at Duke University. Do you want to talk about this?
Come on up here.
I think that's a good idea, but I think that it has to be a collective response, actually, of government and business and families all together at once, because child care is a very expensive proposition. And I think child care at the workplace is a fine thing. And I think you could probably take care of, if you had enough of an infusion of money, the problems of recreational facilities, and even you could deal with the health questions. So yeah, I think it's a fine idea. We just need, in our country, we need a whole lot more attention and more money from government and business, to cooperate to create good standards.
Just to follow up on that, we actually had a national child development bill that was enacted by the Congress of the United States in 1972, which would have provided for access to daycare for all families in the United States on a sliding scale. It was vetoed by President Richard Nixon on the grounds that it was a collectivist measure that would lead toward a communist destruction of a family. Yes, sir. The question is, could I comment on two groups of people within these movements, women in the African-American civil rights movement and lesbians within the women's movement? Women were the backbone of the civil rights movement. There's been some very interesting writing about that issue. A man named Charles Payne has written a book on the Mississippi civil rights movement, which highlights and emphasizes the degree to which women were pivotal to the entire movement. Women did not get the headlines that men did. One of the problems here is the degree to which black preachers got an awful lot of the headlines, and black preachers are not necessarily sympathetic to women's rights across the board. And one of the problems Ella Baker had within the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was the degree to which she was a victim of sex discrimination within that group, even though Ella Baker was probably as important to the civil rights movement as anybody was. But if you think about where the movement starts, Rosa Parks and Joanne Robinson in Montgomery, Fannie Lou Hamer in Mississippi, and countless others in Mississippi, the degree to which women are really the ones who were helping to make it happen and pivotal to the whole structure of the movement. Within the feminist movement, I believe that lesbian feminists have played a very significant role. There was a major controversy within the National Organization for Women. It was one of the things that helped to polarize and weaken the National Organization for Women during the first 10 years of its existence. A reluctance to identify now with the issue of lesbian rights, and to suppress the degree to which that was an issue of concern to women generally. On the other hand, I think that in the aftermath of disagreement or tension, there was a real movement forward on the part of NOW, beginning in the mid-1970s, toward actively advocating on behalf of lesbians and their rights and their perspectives. Certainly, many of the women's liberation groups were even more responsive and supportive of that, and I think there would be no question that lesbians have played a very significant role within the overall women's movement, without saying that they would be a majority or the dominating force within the movement.
I think we'll take two more questions.
Let's get a question from him. Yes, two more questions. Over there. No, go ahead, please. Well, you know, litigation strategies are interesting. They're important to pursue. They also are conservative. One of the reasons you end up having the predominant focus on litigation within the civil rights movement is not only because it's important to change and get correction of the fundamental law of the land, but also because that seemed a safer way than to go the route of, let's say, economic radicalism. And there's been a very good article written about that by Robert Korstad, one of my colleagues, and Nelson Lichtenstein. I think that litigation has been basically, until the last few years at least, fairly successful for the civil rights movement. It's also been fairly successful for the women's movement. One of the reasons why the defeat of the Equal Rights Amendment is not as devastating as it might appear to be is the degree to which decisions by the courts have mostly accomplished what the Equal Rights Amendment was setting out to do. And so there is far less existence of the kinds of invidious legal treatments of women that were there 35 or 40 years ago. So litigation has been a very effective strategy. Title IX has been a major force on the higher education side, passed in 1972, for very significant changes and also a very successful litigation departure point for women's rights groups. So that's been very important. In the back there, yes. How has post-colonial theory affected my understanding as an historian? I'm sorry? Hasn't had an effect. I confess to not really being up on post-colonial theory. If I were to have more time to spend time doing that, it might well have an effect, but right now I don't really... I know about it, but I'm still spending most of my time reading history books.
Maybe one last okay. one here.
Just one about the implications of your research. Do you think that the time has passed for single-sex schools for girls or for black schools for children?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you think the time has passed for still is a role, perhaps?
Mm-hmm.
Are we dealing with this issue?
Yeah. The question is, do I think that single-sex colleges and schools for girls and for blacks of any age, childhood up to college? All right, I'm going to make one, I'll do two answers to that. First of all, I believe that there is a very significant role for single-sex colleges and that places like Mount Holyoke and Smith and Bryn Mawr and other places as places where women leaders are continuing to come forward and making a major contribution is very, very important. And I think it's a very strong and important and positive presence. Similarly, I believe that historically black colleges and universities, Morehouse, Spelman, Howard, a whole variety of schools that are not now totally black, but certainly overwhelmingly black, I believe that's still a very important option and, again, a good departure point. Many of the most important African-American leaders come out of Spelman and Morehouse, for example. When you talk about the earlier grades, I think one of the things, and this is a comment that may or may not resonate, when we talk about desegregation, it's really important to talk about not only the gains that have come through desegregation, but what's been lost as well. And one of the things that's been lost through desegregation is precisely the sense of pride, affirmation, and identification with a black institution. Dudley High School that I talked about in my the example of Greensboro, Dudley High School is now what became a majority white high school. It lost some of the importance and saliency for the black community that came from its having been a place where blacks gathered, rallied, and had a sense of real pride and determination. I'm not arguing for a return to segregated schools, but I recognize the degree to which there is something to be said about places where people can come together and have a sense of strength and pride in their own group identity. And that's one of the reasons why in the United States right now, in the whole charter school movement, there are significant numbers of African Americans who are signing up for and embracing the charter school movement because it allows precisely that kind of group dynamic that has been missing from a totally desegregated environment.
I'd like to ask Professor Paul Krauss to come and thank our speaker, please.
Yes, my name is Paul Krauss, and I'm a member of the faculty in the History Department at UBC. On behalf of everyone here, Bill, and everyone who's met with you and with Lorna all week, I want to thank you. I also want, that's a mega thank you. I also want to make a mini plug and a micro embellishment. The two of those are related. The mini plug is for the books, some of the books that Bill has written that are on sale. You'll find them as you leave the auditorium tonight. And in them, and in the work that Bill is currently working on, I think you'll find ample evidence of the central idea that informed Bill's talk tonight, which is the terribly important place the community holds in our efforts to secure individual rights. That's true in his work on African Americans, on women, and particularly in his new work that deals with black politics during the age of segregation in the United States. So that's the mini embellishment and the micro plug. The mega thanks is for helping us address some knotty questions here in the land of the vertical mosaic, the questions that you attack in the land of the melting pot apply to us as well. Wherever you've gone this week, you've brought your wit, your wisdom, and you really made it happen for all of us here at UBC. So thanks very much.